Thanks so much. Am I on there, Ben? Is that okay? Excellent. Thank you. Thanks for your welcome. Thanks for coming and for making the time to be here on a Saturday as the summer nervously begins. Really, really grateful for you offering time and energy to be here. I hope that it's really beneficial to you. Thanks as well to Matt for working so hard to put this together. It's a big deal for Matt, who carries a lot of responsibility in multiple other areas, I can promise you, to give time to this as well. But we do it because we see it as valid and in fact vital for what we're doing as we go forward as a church. Again, if you're not part of the King, you're more than welcome. We're thrilled that you're here. But being the pastor of the church, I guess it's my job today to speak a little bit on behalf of the big picture, the vision, what it is that we're doing as a church, what is our mission, where are we going, and at the same time, hopefully, to equip you in a way that will help you in the tasks that you particularly have as business people. So let me start by just talking about some big picture things. I'm sure that if you're running a business, you will have spent some time at least thinking, if not framing, some kind of mission statement, some kind of vision statement, or the various different pieces of that businesses are expected to formulate, so that you're able to understand your own workings and what are your own priorities, and also communicate to people who are either working for you or even to customers, clients. What is it that we do? What is our distinct goal? What is our mission? And certainly for churches, it's not unhelpful to have the same kind of thing in place. You'd expect people who are sort of paid to do words, like me, if you like, preachers, to come out with perfect kind of vision, mission statements. We find it still very difficult, probably because I tend to like using lots of words. And the thing about mission statements is that conciseness is a real goal. So what we've been doing in recent months, maybe years, is working on a sort of a six-part statement of our mission, which we've more recently put into an acronym. Hope you're impressed. CREATE, okay, which I'm not sure this is still a work in progress, so I'm being very vulnerable here by letting you know what it is. It's not done and dusted, but I'll let you in. It's a fairly good expression of what we are trying to do, but it's not a very, it's not necessarily the perfect wordsmith stuff. If I was to put an overarching sort of what is the big picture? What are we trying to achieve? It would actually be, it's not on this screen, it would be to turn idolaters into worshippers. Now that sounds, we don't tend to put that on our letterheaded stuff. It doesn't sound particularly pleasant. It comes across a little bit too confrontational. And it's easy to misinterpret. What an idolater is basically, frankly, it's what we've all been, it's what we all are. The teaching that we've learned from the Bible and from Jesus himself is that it's part of human nature to worship. We're born worshiping. We don't just worship on a Sunday. We worship from the moment we come out of the womb. We are worshippers. Everybody longs for things. Everybody yearns for things. Everybody desires things. And the Bible would say that's really that instinct is a feature of our worship. It's part of what it means to be human. We're made for a relationship with him, and our ultimate yearning and longing is actually for him. And one of the greatest theologians and philosophers and thinkers of all time, Saint Augustine, said our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. That's one of his famous prayers from his Confessions. You've made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. That would be true of all humanity, not just saints. That's true of everybody. We're all restless until we find our rest in him. He's the one that can actually bring that satisfaction, that fulfillment, that sense of purpose and meaning to life. And that being the case, we are eager to help people to find the true God worthy of their worship, because when they're not worshiping him, they're worshiping other things. Good things, not necessarily horrendous, wicked, evil things in the eyes of the world, just things, things other than God, created things. And that won't ultimately be the best thing for them. So our desire is to turn people, not by plugging them into mains, I mean by persuading, helping, convincing that God is the one worth desiring, worth worshiping. And the process we are going through as we do this is you could put it down to six pieces, okay? We want to consistently pray. We want to learn to be diligent in prayer. Nothing happens without prayer. We tend to rely on our own strength way too easily. We're committed to prayer because we know that prayer is actually the main way in which we achieve things as a church. We put that first on purpose. We recognize cultures. So we're not, like Jesus, we want to come into the world and learn the world. Jesus came from heaven but became a man. He learned human culture. He learned a certain way of doing and living and speaking. And he came into the culture in which he was sent to. We need to do that, to learn Brighton, to learn our culture, learn the ways of our city and our environment so that we're able to communicate more effectively. If we just sort of stand behind pillars and occasionally yell at people, we're doing something quite unlike the God of the Bible, who didn't just stand back and yell, but came in amongst people and made friends and connected and learned their ways. We extend friendship. So we don't just listen and learn, we also offer friendship, we offer ways to bless, we look for ways to serve our friends, our communities, even our city. If it comes to that, big projects like helping with things like the marathon that we've helped over the years and stuff, to extend friendship to our city. Adding sites, services and cities. We're at a stage now where we have 8 Sunday meetings, eight different parts of the city, or 8 different services, I should say, on a Sunday, which are like front doors, 8 of them. We think the more places where people can come and connect, the more front doors we have, the more opportunity there will be for people to come in and learn about the God who we've got to know. So we have 4 locations currently, 8 different services in them. We talk about them as front doors. Transforming idolaters into worshippers is the process whereby when people, having come to Christ, come into the church even, we know that that's not the job done. Coming to a few meetings doesn't really change anyone's heart, not on its own. What happens is you come into a community, you build friendships, you rub up against each other, you get the hump with people, and you get disappointed, and you walk through real life, real challenges, real pain. And in all of that, you're changing. God is using it to make you a worshiper because your heart is really having surgery done on it. And that can happen quickly or slowly, but it happens in community. It doesn't happen when we're isolated. And so the T1 is about us working together to help one another to change. And then E, equipping for cultural renewal. We don't change so that we can be a nice community behind closed doors, a nice spiritual club, a nice huddle. We change because God's heart, God's desire, God's longing is to reach out to the world. He's changing people and transforming them in order to send them, just like he sent his son Jesus, sending us to bring renewal, to bring blessing, goodness, transformation to people's lives across culture. And that means our city. That means that's why we want to open front doors locally. Also, to open front doors in cities beyond. We're at the stage now where, by God's grace, we have a couple of church plants in Berlin, and one family, or I say one family, several families actually, and 2 of them from this church at the moment are getting ready to fly off to Amsterdam to start a new church there, to open a front door in Amsterdam, because we see that as a vital city for this kind of a church to be established. And so we want to keep equipping people for cultural renewal, but not just so we can start new meetings, so that we can bless the culture through every means possible. Because Jesus cares about every aspect of life. There's not one square inch of creation over which God does not shout the word, mine. That's a quote from a Dutch theologian called Abraham Kuyper, who actually became the prime minister of Holland. He was so committed to what he said. He said, right, in that case, I can't just be a theologian. I must get involved in society. I must get involved. In his case, he got into politics. He became a leader in the civil community because he wanted to influence, in a gracious way, influence the world for good from God's point of view. And that can be done in a stupid, ugly, authoritarian, right-wing kind of way, or it can be done in a subversive, cocky, rebellious, left-wing kind of way. Jesus actually is amazingly subversive to both styles. Jesus tells us to be salt and light. Jesus tells us to go into the community expressing his mercy, being distinct, being different. And that means sometimes we have to be a little bit unpopular, but the main thing we're trying to do is love and serve people so that they see the goodness of God and are drawn into his gospel, into his community, in fact, into the church. So we have a huge agenda, a huge mission. And I might as well tell you that. Okay, it's worth me just saying, first up, I'm here with an agenda, okay? That's not all you're going to get from us, but we do feel called to do something wonderful for God with our lives. And the reason I'm saying that is because I want you to understand, as business people, you are at the heart of that. That's not incidental to you. It's not like, well, I have my spiritual life where I do God's things and then I have business. That's not the way that the Bible teaches, and for us to understand that is vital. But I want to also do what it says in E there, equip for cultural renewal, and that's really what we're doing in days like this. Things like what we're doing today are fitting particularly into the E on that acronym. Equip with the gospel. Okay, I could stand here as a pastor and try to equip you with business skills. I think I would probably be shooting several yards wide of the mark. It's not my area of expertise particularly. There are people here who will do a much better job of that as the day goes on. I think what I can do is hopefully bring some foundational things to help keep you equipped in the gospel, the vital beginning point for all of us. And in fact, in a sense, it's the beginning point, and in another sense, it's the ongoing point. We never go beyond the gospel. We don't go beyond the good news of the kingdom of God. We don't go beyond the good news of Jesus. We just go deeper into it. Some people say it's not that the gospel is the ABC of the Christian life, it's the A to Z of the Christian life. And that's something that we're discovering all the time. The more we get to know the good news that we first heard when we became a Christian, the first moment where we understood Jesus and how good he was, the more we understand that, the better it is for our lives 20, 30, 40, 50 years later. The best news for you is still the same news that you got when you first met Christ. Still the best information there could possibly be. If it stopped being good news to you, either it's not being said right, or you're not quite hearing it. Something's a piece missing, because the news is still as good as it gets. So let's just talk about the gospel's impact on business. Let's talk about the way that the gospel influences our business lives. I'm going to do it by just naming a few headings. I've got six, and I'll see if I can get through all of them. The first of them, very quickly, gospel honesty. Gospel honesty. The gospel sets us free from false ideas of ourselves. I think that it would be surely as true in business as it is in any walk of life that we are at least tempted a great deal to present to the world and even to ourselves a certain idea of ourselves. Maybe even we feel that's, I mean, it's part of marketing, it's part of how we need to present well, we need to do a good job of giving off the best kind of brand for us. That's a huge part of your lives right now. The way you're branded, the way you're perceived by the public, if you were to ask them, because we sometimes think branding is what we tell the world, and actually branding isn't really what we tell the world about ourselves. Branding is what they understand that we've told them. That's why Jesus didn't just say, "Who do you say that I am?" to his disciples. He said, "Who do they say that I am?" It's interesting, isn't it? He cared about branding. Jesus was very concerned about, did the public get the point? Do they get the message? How much have they understood yet? And the answers so far weren't particularly brilliant. But he was concerned about, have people understood the message? And I guess for us, the fact that we need to communicate well will often slide over into a case where we're kind of having to, I guess, present a version of ourselves that we can almost take on as our identity. We're having to present ourselves and we start to believe or disbelieve that we are valuable or worth something on the basis of how well our brand is being received, or even how well we're doing in very concrete terms, you know, looking at a sheet of statistics, looking at a spreadsheet of figures for this month or this year, especially if we set it against a spreadsheet of figures for those guys who we're competing with, or those guys who you know, they've just started just a few months ago and they're kind of the new guys on the block. The obvious need for us to compete well can creep into our soul to the point where what's being dealt with isn't just business smarts, but a sense of identity. Am I doing well? Have I done enough to be a worthwhile person? I'm just guessing that might be an issue for some people in business. I know it is. I think it's an issue for everybody. I think that's the way we live. It's the way we're wired. We want to somehow find a way to validate ourselves, to have achieved and done enough, to have succeeded to the point where, you know, I know I'm something. Now I know it. And some of the greatest leaders in history have been kind enough to actually leave it to posterity. They've actually set out at the early stages of their lives, I know I will have achieved something with my life if X. I think Abraham Lincoln actually put it down, and as a young man, he said, I want to get to the point where I will have achieved something that men whom I respect will look upon what I've done and see me as a great man. It's fascinating. I remember reading that thinking, I wouldn't have quite known that about Lincoln, but that was in it all the way through, everything he went through, the Civil War and emancipating slaves. He was all the time underneath it all. Will people ultimately see me as a great man? I think for a lot of men and women, a lingering yearning for people to respect, have I achieved? Is my business thriving? What do I look like? Am I doing well? And we kind of take our kind of identity pulse frequently, and it can even include this syndrome, a kind of a self-righteousness where we may even as Christians, talking as Christians now, draw into this need for a validation, a kind of a moral validation as well. You know, am I as good a businessman in moral terms as those people are? In fact, I think I'm much more moral. I'm a more righteous. In fact, I'm a Christian businessman. I'm a Christian businesswoman. This is a Christian firm, even. And what the gospel does is it kind of undercuts all of that. But look, Jesus comes along saying, blessed are the poor. The first line of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew's gospel, blessed are the poor in spirit. So he's including, I suppose, material poverty, but also the emotional, spiritual poverty that we often wake up feeling, don't we? Sense of, I'm a failure. I haven't got what I want. I haven't got to where I want to be. I haven't got what it takes. And then you get to know God, and you think, I got even less of what it takes because his standards are much higher. And we're overwhelmed and exhausted. And who's going to comfort me? How can I find a way through? Where can I find any sense of security? And then Jesus comes along saying, blessed. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are you who are poor in spirit. Wow, what a message. First great sermon on the first sentence Sermon on the Mount. Blessed. The word means happy, all right? The word blessed kind of dresses it up in halos and stained glass. Happy are the poor in spirit. If you're poor, if you've realized I can't do this, I haven't got it, I'm never going to be impressive in those terms. And even when I have reached that point, I've got to the end of the rainbow, I've got there, I'll notice, I'll look around, I think this is still vanity, still nothing, it still doesn't satisfy. Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. When we know that, when we stay there and abide there and don't reckon ourselves that special, when we just get satisfied with just a sense of, okay, I'm not that impressive in myself, I'm not that impressed with myself, I'm not. When we're prepared to stay there and just, okay, it's not about me. It's not about me showing off. It's not about me being the best guy in the room, the best guy in the town, the best guy in the city, the best guy in the county. It never will be. If it was, I'd be on a road to disaster. It stops me from overclaiming. It stops me from even sort of some of the rhetoric of this is a Christian firm. I just wanted to mention that. I remember years ago, a friend of mine had a firm which he had a flyer that he put through doors, and it had a little fish at the bottom. And a little fish just saying, "You can trust us," next to it. And apologies if you have this, okay? I don't mean to make you feel uncomfortable if this is you. I don't think that any of you do, but you might do. I think there's something, I mean, apart from the fact that probably in a city like Brighton, putting a little fish is one of the reasons people might not trust you, sadly, because the church's reputation in our city is so negative. So it's not necessarily as clever as you might think it is. But also, what are you putting your confidence in? I'm not sure if that's the way we want to go into the world. You can trust us because we're good people. We're Christians, so we're really good. You can trust us. I wonder if that's slightly overclaiming. I wonder if it's better to underclaim. It's better to just be honest. It's better to say, look, we found a savior. And to overprove, overdeliver. To be able to go into the world and say, I am in need. I'm poor in spirit. I don't mean you put that on your flyer either, okay? That's not business card, you know, poor in spirit. I'm not talking about business cards as such. I'm talking about the disposition of our heart that is often reflected in the way we present ourselves. I think of this, notwithstanding the fact that, guys, we need a good reputation. We must pursue that. We must be looking so that people look at church, look at Christians and say, these are the best guys in the firm, best guys in the factory, best guys in the offices. I love it when people get in touch with us as a church and say, we're so impressed with what you're doing here and here and here and here. And we mustn't let it get to our heads, but it says something wonderful. It says, oh God, thank you, your grace is at work in our lives. People, I mean, I live for the day when people will contact us and say, we want to hire 24 new staff. Who have you got? Because we know that Christians are honest. Wow, imagine that. That's beautiful. But we won't get there by overclaiming. We'll get there by the gospel that thunders out that we don't have anything of our own. Everything we have is a gift of grace. I could go on about that. Let me move on to the second one. The gospel as a motive. Okay, gospel, honesty, gospel motive. Because in Jesus we have righteousness, because we have sufficiency, because we're complete in Christ, there's not the same drivenness that will exist otherwise. Our motives become different when identity is different. There's a great verse that's very relevant to this in Colossians chapter 3. It's actually two or three verses. Let me just read to you. Bondservants, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for your boss, not for your customer, not for your client, not for the customer base in the market, not for them ultimately, knowing that from the Lord you will receive an inheritance as your reward. You're serving the Lord Christ. For the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he's done, and there is no partiality. I love that. Jesus has no partiality. Jesus is not impressed with status, with websites, with branding. He's not impressed with those things. They are necessary in the practicalities of our working lives, but they don't count for much in our engagement with him and our relationship with him. It's based on his grace. We've received so much from him. And so we needn't be chasing in a drivenness, a kind of a reputation, a sense of honor, a sense of status, a sense of having been established. The best kind of status that the world can ever offer you will be very, very, very silly in a few thousand years. It will be irrelevant. It will be embarrassing that you cared so much. I always think about when I'd get into trouble at school at playtime. And say if at playtime, there'd been a fight, there'd been a mix-up and a mess. And at play, we would play Star Wars. It was the early 80s, that was the thing. Everybody was going to be a character from Star Wars. And a bunch of boys, you've got the popular kid gets to play Luke Skywalker. The fairly popular kid gets to play Han Solo. The slightly odd kid gets to play Chewbacca. and the very confused kid gets to play Princess Leia, and you get this kind of mixture of people in the, and then you get into a fight, and then the headmistress has you in her office. What she doesn't say is, now I need to speak to someone important. Which one of you is Luke Skywalker, please? She's not thinking, right, I really care about your status that you guys see. She just sees us as a bunch of boys who probably need a slap. She sees us as the same. There's no bias, there's no partiality. She's not impressed. That was the playground out there where we had this sense of, I'm actually Han Solo. Not as high as him, but I'm definitely higher than him. That's playtime. And in the business world, I know that's how it can feel. These guys, and we're in here. We'd like to be up there with them. Honestly, one day we're going to notice how silly it was. It's playtime. It's the playground in the headmistress's office, if you like. These things will be relativized. So we got to see through some of the trappings sometimes. I'm not saying that these things aren't important in a sense. Obviously, these things help you to achieve things. There's this hierarchy for authority. Sometimes it's just practical realities. You need people in charge and so on and so forth. Oh, fair enough. But we mustn't let that get into our heart, where we get our sense of honor, our sense of well-being, our sense of security from that. It will kill us. I remember when I was really kind of running a youth work. That was my main job. I was based in Bedford. Can anything good come from Bedford? I was... it can, just so you know. I was occasionally, I was running a big youth event nationally, so that made me feel important. I was running a big youth event. We even recorded albums for our youth event. Flipping CDs, with like my name on them. My name on the CDs. I was looking so good in those days. And then I'd be on the train, and someone would phone me on my phone. I'd be sitting amidst loads of guys in suits. I'd be in the commuter train, loads of guys who'd just come back from their important jobs. And I'd be on the train, and they'd be like, I think we can get that guy in the studio to record that. Yeah, I think that's good. And I'm thinking, I look so cool to these guys. They're in their suits, and I've got my skater's clothes on, and I'm talking to my phone about recording, cutting some tracks, man. And then I'd get a phone call about, we can't find that box of crisps. The youth work back in Bedford that was very small and very humble. We run out of crisps, and I'd be like, I don't know where the crisps are. No, I'm sorry. So don't call me. Don't call me on the phone. I want these guys to hear about the big global affairs that I'm dealing with. I don't want them to know that I'm concerned with confectionery. So I know, and this is the way we're very, very concerned. We buy into this. We just need to watch our hearts and know that we have a security that comes from the gospel. Third thing, I'm going to rush these now. Gospel renewal. We contribute to the tending of the garden. We're not, as people in business, doing the sideshow. We're doing the main show. If we see that God is involved in all of life, we get the privilege of knowing even the work we do that's the Monday to Friday, even some of it that seems almost a bit menial. Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, long, 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 long chapter about the resurrection. Long chapter describing the resurrection and its importance. What I find fascinating is the final verse, verse 58, 1 Corinthians 15. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing, and you might think, well, he's talking about pastors. No. He's talking about Christians in their work. Always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. It's not in vain. It's not vanity. The word vanity in the Bible conjures up all kinds of thoughts. Just meaningless. Just doing stuff it's like vapor, like when you breathe on a mirror and it just gradually disappears. That's all there is. Is that my work? Is that my legacy? Paul says, no, because Jesus is raised, the work we do for him, whether it's through your firm, whether it's through your business, whether it's through your relationship with the clients, you're doing it for him, it's not in vain. It has eternal significance. Why? Because Jesus is raised. He's raised in a new body. He's raised in a body that affirms creation. He didn't raise as a ghost. He didn't raise, say, well, I'm off to heaven, that cloud that we talk about where people play harps. It's not real. It's not practical. It's not. You can't touch it. You can't feel it. No. Not true. Jesus was raised in a real body. Jesus affirms creation. Jesus affirms a new heavens and a new earth he's going to create, not just a heaven out there, a new earth. That's the story the Bible teaches, the restoring and the renewing of all things, which means that our work, our labor, even the most trivial seeming labor, if it's done in his name, it can have eternal worth. It can have eternal meaning. Well, I'm just working so hard. I don't feel like I'm getting anywhere with this. Be careful. If you see it as work for God, it's got value. Fourth thing, gospel worldview. The last point meant all our work matters to God. This point means God matters to all our work, which is a bit more sobering, I suppose. And the different assumptions we can have about the world. What are the things that this calls into question? I suppose, again, it's about the idols of our heart, the things that we desire, the things that we want desperately. If you've ever done a SWOT analysis in a team, you've sat around a board and put SWOT, you know, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. From a spiritual angle, you'll know that the threats are not the same as the world around you. The threats that the world sees are not the threats that you see. The weaknesses that the world sees aren't the weaknesses you see. Especially if Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit. The kingdom turns things on its head, and we've got to be good at seeing things through a Christian worldview. Now, I haven't time at all to go into that, but that's one of the reasons I want to recommend some of the books. I'll just touch those before I finish. Fifth thing, gospel teamwork. We talk about community as a church all the time, small groups, getting into small group. I just want to say to you, as someone in business, apply this in the way that's right for you, but think about it. What are the people that you're around? Are they helping you with this kind of stuff? Keeping your integrity, focusing on the gospel, on the grace of God in Christ? Are they helping you to maintain a Christian worldview? It may be that being in a small group with no other business people is quite good for you. It may be that really helps you because they sort of see the world from a different angle. They ask different kinds of questions to you, and they'll keep you accountable in a different kind of way. It may be. It may also be for some of you the other way around. It may be that you need to be in a small group with business people because you'll be able to talk about the issues that you particularly face in business. Now, I'm not going to say, well, as a church, our line is all people in business should be in small groups with people in business, or vice versa. I think you should think about it, though. I think you should think about, who are the people that help me to focus on Jesus in my business? Am I in community with them? Am I around them enough for them to be able to ask me questions and dig into my life and talk things through and pray together? I think community is so important. It's part of what it means for us to be gospel people. Finally, gospel vision. I've mentioned it earlier. We're on a mission. We feel God's called us to achieve things, and we want to achieve them. Reality is, we only achieve them as we all are involved. And again, business plays a huge part in it. Just mentioned earlier on Amsterdam, we have a couple of families moving out there. One of them is going out there because a business guy, who's actually based in the States, has said, I am going to employ you out there. I'll give you a salary, I'll give you a job out there in Amsterdam so you can relocate there because I believe in you getting involved in church planting. That's a fascinating way to behave. I'm praying all the time that will happen more and more and more and more. People who are entrepreneurial in the business sector might be able to line up well with church vision and say, how can we get this happening quicker? Not just through funding, although funding's important, but also because often business people will just have initiative. They'll be thinking, yeah, but if we did it this way, you'd get there quicker. If you did it this way, you'd be smarter. And people like me, I deliberately surround myself with people who are a lot cleverer, think a lot quicker. And the part that you guys play in how we achieve that create thing may be much, much more than you think it is. We need creative people to create. And it may be that there's some in this room who've got a big part to play in that. That's all I'm going to say, except please read the books on the back. The book by Keller, that one at the bottom, is short and punchy and really, really good. Really fun to read. The top left is dense and slow and heavy. Some of you will love that kind of a book. I do, and if you do, then you just it's worthy of hours and hours of time. And the Gruden book is I think it's just a good practical book on what business means in the Bible. So there's other books on the back as well. I particularly want to draw attention to those three. Brilliant. Matt, Dan.